Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. If ever there was iconic music, that may be it. The theme from Rocky, and I know you're expecting me to introduce Sylvester Stallone now, but we're not going to do that. We're going to introduce a real prize fighter from Chicago, somebody who represents progressive politics, has for his entire career, put up the good fight, won the battles he can during his career, and now has taken the time to write all about him. He hides nothing in the book called The Good Fight, Life Lessons from a Chicago Progressive. And joining me on the podcast, former alderman and current professor over at UIC, Dick Simpson. Dick, welcome to the podcast. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as always, Paul.
In the past, of course, we've talked about issues of the day, but because you did have your autobiography come out, I wanted to take some time and just talk to you about that. People get to hear your views on things, but let's be honest, depending on the age of people, they may not realize. Let me just go to the recent past first. Well, you've been a professor, but tell my listeners a little bit about your role in politics in terms of serving as an alderman and that sort of thing.
Well, in 1967-68, I was state campaign manager for Eugene McCarthy in his run for presidency. We lost that battle at the 1968 Democratic Convention.
And we'll talk about that.
And then I became alderman in 1971 through 79, and I led the opposition bloc against the famous Mayor Richard J. Daley and his successor, Mayor Mike Blandig. I went on to run against Dan Rostenkowski, then the most powerful congressman in America, in 1992 and 1994. And I've helped with dozens of campaigns and transition teams and the other aspects of politics and government ever since.
All right. So for people who are now putting you in Chicago history, these are the Richard J. Daley days, these are the Michael Blandick days, and these are the Harold Washington days as well that you put so much efforts in. So now that we get that frame, let's fill the frame with some details. I want to go back to spend a little bit of time for your beginnings because, you know, this progressive thing was not something that struck you when you turned 40. You were a troublemaker, so to speak, from when your young days growing up in Texas. And I'm talking about an organization you started called Students for Direct Action. Tell listeners about what you're doing as a young guy in Texas. You already had your progressive values.
Well, so in my sophomore year when I started at the University of Texas, I ended up being part of civil rights demonstrations. They were a little different than the ones in Chicago and the ones in the South. We did integrate restaurants, but we also integrated movie theaters. We had what was called the stand-in movie movement, and we stood in long lines in front of the theaters across from campus and blocked the moviegoers from enjoying those movies and costing the theater owners a lot of money until 6 months later they settled and, for the first time in history, integrated the movie theaters. This was in 1960 and 1961, about 5 years before the Civil Rights Act passed.
What do you think, Dick? What was it about your upbringing? Because, you know, you grew up in Texas, which is not exactly the, you know, bastion of liberalism. What was it in your life that just instilled this sense of writing what seemed wrong to you from such an early age?
Well, there were a bunch of factors. First of all, I had an unusual background in Texas. I was a Boy Scout and an Eagle Scout, and I was a camp counselor, and I was a camp counselor even when the camp was with all African-American scouts. The white counselor stayed on and worked with those weeks as well. I was a caddy at the country club where my father had a membership. And all the other caddies were, of course, African-American, and I was just my father's son. But it meant I hung out with African-Americans at a time on an equal basis, working an equal job at a time when that didn't happen. I also had a very religious background at first. My grandfather was a preacher. We went to church, and I believe those things that they said at church. And integration.
Yeah. Did your parents instill those values? Did they share your values, or were they a bit, standoffish, going, "Hey, you know, careful, Dick. This is
my mother
60s.
Had somewhat similar values. Certainly, all the social values. Both were Democrats. Everyone in Texas was a Democrat in those days. My father was much more conservative and much more bigoted in his views about race. I didn't share much in terms of values with my father. So it was partially parental, particularly my mother's influence, partly religion, and partly just experience, which was unusual in a southern state like Texas at the time. And once I started down the path of working in civil rights, I ended up studying African politics and graduate studies, ended up, I didn't even know whether I was a Democrat or Republican until the Kennedy-Nixon election. Yeah. And I just heard the debate on radio, not on television. I was driving to a conference and decided, well, if that's the choice between Nixon and Kennedy, if this is what the parties stand for, I think I'll go with Kennedy.
And when you write the book, you sort of address four dimensions of your life. There's politics, there's love, there's religion, there's teaching. Let's talk about all of them. Let's start with politics because it's probably the real reason you wrote the book in terms of reader's vantage point. One of the things you write about politics, you compared it as a profession, so to speak, to carpentry and plumbing, which, of course, I think Richard Nixon, Watergate, but that's not what you meant. You basically say the point is books don't teach you the kind of skills you need when you want to be a carpenter, you want to be a plumber, you want to be an electrician, and you equate politics to that.
Yeah, we've joked, Paul, that I wouldn't hire you to do my house if I was building a house from scratch.
Smart move.
Just because you, read a book or saw a TV program about carpentry or plumbing or electricity. It's the same thing with politics. It's a craft. You have to learn how to do press conferences. You have to learn how to do debates. You have to learn how to meet constituents, how to organize a campaign, when to do each thing. When I was first starting out with the McCarthy campaign, I did student politics, but not adult politics. When I did adult politics, I had to go downtown and talk to the leader at the time of the McCarthy effort in Illinois and have him tell me, well, what's this petition stuff? Where do we print them? How do we get them out? How do we organize? And I would come back and pretend I knew all this stuff to the people who were the volunteers working in the congressional district. But you just don't know that stuff unless you've actually been through it. They're good books. I think my Winning Elections in the 21st Century is an excellent book, but you can't learn everything from even that. You have to really practice the politics and learn the skills and learn what you're best at. There are very different skills between, for instance, candidates and campaign managers.
Yeah, and in fact, I took a I have a degree in political science, and all my professors were political scientists. You know, I mean, they were academicians. You teach, and so I'm sort of curious. I mean, poli-sci teachers, in my experience, and probably true for most, they become poli-sci teachers because they find the topic interesting. They're interested in the presidency. They're interested in the powers of Congress. But you lived it. So I'm curious, in your classroom and obviously in your writing, how does that inform your teaching? I mean, because you get to stand up there and say, well, let me tell you what it was like when I was sitting in that city council chair, not just talking about what it would be like to be interested in the concept.
Actually, that isn't the way I do it, either one. I'm pretty good as a stump speaker in politics if I'm campaigning, but I'm not a terribly great lecturer. And what I try and do is organize the experiences so the students discover it for themselves, sometimes called experiential learning. So I bring in a lot of outside speakers, Tony Preckwinkel, Jesus Garcia, Alderman Ed Burke, and so on, to my classes and have them tell what is going on in the city and the government at all levels. I have them see movies where they actually empathetically are part of campaigns or protests or whatever part of politics. And I have them do exercises. They practice democracy, not just talk about it. And usually I require them to do civic engagement activities outside the classroom. So I try and combine a background that gives them facts and framework, but to actually have them gain the knowledge from the doing and reflecting.
So in 1967, as you said, you were the Illinois campaign manager for Eugene McCarthy. You were a political neophyte at that time, pretty idealistic. And you were at the Democratic convention. In fact, when all these riots were going on, I remember you wrote about the fact that you didn't run away from them. You went down to them. But you lost. You write about that. Hubert Humphrey won. You lost everything you wanted in the platform, but that's when you learned. And what I love about your book is this is not just about your life, but if people are interested in politics, they're getting lessons about politics. And one of the things you learn, teach us, is when you're trying to make change, you don't start at the top. You don't try and change the president, because that's probably not going to happen quickly.
And it turns out, even if it did, you wouldn't get the change you want. So after we lost the McCarthy campaign, we went back and began building from the grassroots up with the Independent Precinct Organization on the north side of Chicago, and we changed Chicago history permanently. And I talk a little bit in the book about how all that happened and all the campaigns ever since over the last 50 years, and why the history turned towards, say, Harold Washington and his progressive administration. And we were part of that. We made history, but we made it from the bottom, not from having elected a president and hoping that an imperial president would somehow dictate that we be better Democrats in the sense of Democratic participants here at the local level and throughout the country.
So you run for alderman in 1971 as an independent, so you weren't part of the Democratic machine. The machine is powerful enough now, but back at that time in the 70s under Richard J. Daley, man, it was powerful. And you ran from the 44th Ward and you won. One of the things you wrote, again, piece of advice for readers, is always make sure you do one important thing first thing in the morning. You had an example there about how much everybody hates Lincoln Towing. Anybody who lives in the city hates Lincoln Towing. I guess you weren't successful on getting rid of them. We're still working on that. But you were serving under a mayor who truly ruled with an iron fist, and you were a real thorn in his side.
Yes, what we were fighting about wasn't the particular piece of legislation on the floor of the council. And I lost nearly all those votes over the next 8 years. Often by margins as much as 49-1 or 44-2 or whatever. But we were fighting over the future of the city. We were laying a framework for when, say, a Harold Washington would come into office, of things that could be done that would change the city permanently. And when Harold came in, as his supporters like to say, he raised the floor of government. And some of those were our ideas, even though they'd been offered decades before or years before, depending on when they came into being. You know, Paul Douglas once had an idea when he was senator that we could get by with many fewer bridge tenders and by simply getting them to move from bridge to bridge and open the bridges sequentially. And that was an idea that it took 30 years to implement. Even when I was alderman, I introduced the legislation for the same thing and lost every time. Until they began to run out of money and they had to have fewer bridge tenders to make the budget work.
You also, basically, you had Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, sort of saying, how dare you question him. I just love this story. If you just tell it really briefly, the notion of when Daley wanted to appoint Tom Keene, little Tommy Keene, to the Board of Appeals, and you're like, what the heck's going on here? And Daley just couldn't understand why you didn't understand the importance of nepotism.
Yes, and we didn't understand at the time that he was doing all these special jobs and favors for his sons, but the fight was over the appointment of Tom Keene, Jr., who was the son of the most powerful alderman in the city, Tom Keene, Sr., who was the floor leader for Daley, and in addition, he was a vice president of Arthur Rubloff Company, and it was a clear conflict of interest to have the vice president of the biggest real estate company in the city be part of the Zoning Board of Appeals that would control the value of property. And so I just simply raised the question, and the room exploded, and Daley had the longest tirade in his career, pointing out that he didn't appoint Tom Keene just because the man's name was Keene. He had known the baby since he was a baby, and he had a fine Polish-American mother as well as an Irish father. So why shouldn't he appoint this person? Of course, it turned out that two of the Daley sons were actually getting special contracts from the city, one for insurance and the others for receiverships and the court system.
Amazing. You retire after two terms, 80-hour work weeks. You had created a lot of progressive organizations. You felt they needed to just be able to function on their own. And they really didn't. The alderman who replaced you in the 44th didn't really take the care and put the effort in to maintain these organizations, these grassroots types efforts you were starting.
Yeah, we lost the neighborhood government, the 44th Ward Assembly, and all the other components of it. The alderman that I did elect to succeed me, Bruce Young, did keep them for 2 years. Then he retired, And when he did, the machine came back in, and the machine, of course, didn't want the neighborhood to be a strong democratic, participatory kind of operation that would curtail the alderman's ability to vote with the mayor. And so they destroyed the neighborhood government that we had built in the 44th Ward. And eventually IPO had to merge with IVI. I went through a lot of losses, like the other people who were part of this movement, over the years. And one of the things about something like neighborhood government, you have to really embed it in law. And when I tried to pass that ordinance in the city council to require neighborhood government or embed it in law, I lost 44-4.
Part of the reason I think you also retired, there had been a lot of stress on your personal relationship. So I just want to take a moment. You've had several relationships in your life, and you've lost a couple to cancer. I mean, you've had some really tough times, but also divorce stepped into play. I don't want to go into great detail about all that, but that personal side, it is spelled out specifically in the book. But it looks like, in many ways, the love of your life certainly was your first marriage to Mary Scott, who you called Scott. Talk about the importance of the love relationships through your life and how they impacted your work as a politician.
Well, I found particularly the women in my life have completely reshaped me over time. Sometimes it did take something like divorce to drive home the point. And part of it is the need to communicate. Part of it is the need to be able to pay attention to the other person, to give them space to grow and to develop. And they were sometimes painful lessons. Often they were lovely lessons. But they developed a softer side of myself and a more sensitive side some of the time. I still fall prey to the usual problems most men have of being too inattentive to their partners.
Harold Washington comes along. It seems so long ago, but in many ways, Harold is just still alive in so many people's minds. Talk about the importance of Harold Washington to the city and what he meant.
Well, what the people who were part of Harold's administration say is that he raised the floor of government. So before Harold Washington, when I was alderman, even as an alderman, you had to take a pad of paper and a pencil and go copy documents from the city comptroller. They were not public. Harold passed his first executive order, which I helped get done, was the Freedom of Information Order, which has since become law in several different ways, and guarantees citizens' right to the government, to the documents their money is paying for. Harold created affirmative action in city government and jobs and contracts, which we never had before Harold Washington, and the numbers of minorities in city government and contracts to City Hall are vastly better than they were, say, under Daley or Blandick or Byrne. Harold created more emphasis on the neighborhood, economic development in the neighborhood, not just downtown. He rerouted the federal government money for community development to community organizations to deliver the services rather than just hire more patronage workers. So he really did transform. It's usually what's called a progressive administration in urban politics literature versus a growth machine under both Daleys.
You decided to take that progressive nature to Washington, if you could, in 1992. You ran for Congress, but you took on Dan Rostenkowski. Now, we all know he ultimately ended up in prison for doing some things, but he was an incredibly powerful congressman. Many people would say, how could you take him on? But your answer was, you can't win if you don't play.
Yeah, you got to be in the game, and taking on major figures like Richard J. Daley or Dan Rostenkowski really allow you to highlight the platform and make a difference. Whether you win or not, you are able to transform the real discussion and to force change. Some things that are as simple as I got Dan Rostenkowski so worried that he had to open several senior citizen centers just before the election and things of that sort. With Daley, many of the ordinances that carry Richard J. Daley's name are actually mine. One example would be the 1% for Art campaign that allows public art to be in sponsored by government when they build massive new projects. So you can get things done if you're in the big fight. To mess around with just little squeaky fights with minor figures isn't really worth the time and effort.
So just a look at today. There's so much to deal with today. Gerrymandering issues, money in campaigns, the Citizens United case. Do you look at your career and wish you were, on some level, still in city council, or you were in Washington or making a difference that way? And because there seems to be a deadlock everywhere else you look, could you be making a difference, or is the landscape not really ready for somebody like you today anymore? I don't know.
No, I think it is. I think the Bernie Sanders campaign showed that. I'm not saying I would be exactly like Bernie, but it shows there's a hunger for some dramatic change. One of the better periods I had when I was not in office was leading the Illinois Coalition Against Reagan Economics. And Reagan was going to cut $400 million of money to local governments, among many other bad things in the Reagan period. He did some good things. I'm not arguing the whole case. But we were able to mobilize enough to force the Congress to block Reagan's worst budget cuts in terms of what would have happened to Chicago. And I think I would be able to do that if I were in the Congress today. But I'm not in the Congress. I'm still teaching, and I still try and encourage students, no matter what their ideology, to be involved and to be part of the fight and to try and do it in an honorable fashion that doesn't totally demonize the opponents but does make a clear difference of agendas so that there's a real choice and to really involve people in politics in a fundamental and important way. I've spent the last couple of decades working on civic engagement, and we're really having a renaissance of that at the universities and even beginning to at the high schools, and I am pleased to see that begin to develop.
You fought the good fight, and you kept the good faith throughout. You still do that today, and you sort of look at much of your life and say, look, you know, even what you've done has been enough. But do you have any regrets? Do you look back, and is there anything you'd say, I wish I hadn't done that? Or I wish I had done that?
Well, there were some things. For instance, back when I was running for Congress, my wife at the time, Sarah Jane Avedon, developed cancer and had an operation. And the operation was successful, and my kids were there. When she was coming out of surgery, I ducked out for a campaign event and then came back, knowing she would be perfectly safe and was going to be in recovery for a while before she was wheeled to her room. But she felt that as a major betrayal, and I think she was right in that. So I've made mistakes in my life. There's no doubt about that. And so there are many things I wish had been differently. But overall, I end the book, and sort of my current feeling is it's all been enough. It's been good. I've been pleased and fortunate in my life, even though there have been hardships and difficulties and painful moments.
The book is called The Good Fight, Life Lessons from a Chicago Progressive. I will say there are some other surprising details, startling details that you come across in the book, but I'm not going to give those away on this interview because I want people to check the book out. What we've done here is given a review of your life in general and hopefully whetted people's appetites to say, I'd like to learn more about Dick Simpson and his fight throughout his career and also maybe learn a few of those things that give the reader pause to go, that's interesting. It certainly gave me a few of those moments. And Dick, people can get the book, obviously, on Amazon.com. Any special place you want them to get it?
No, they can do that or through Golden Alley Press, but if any bookstore can order it. It is available. And actually, if they buy it before January 1st, there's a 20% discount that we put on it because it's really technically pre-publication. The official date of publication is January 1st.
Oh, smart move. Well, fortunately, I already have it, and I have read it cover to cover. Once again, The Good Fight by former Alderman Dick Simpson. I highly encourage you to read it. Dick, thank you for a great career. It continues. It's not over. You keep going, but I'm glad to get to at least be a part of tapping into your brain from time to time. Thanks for sharing your life on the podcast.
Thank you, and I will continue the conversation as all the events unfold, particularly this next year.
Absolutely. It's A Good Fight, and the book is The Good Fight. Dick Simpson. Thank you, sir.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday. While the merry bells keep ringing, happy holiday to you.
Yes, happy holidays, everybody. 'Tis the season. We'll be doing some holiday moments here and there on the podcast going forward as we move through the season. And one of those key questions that people always have, I think, if you are a wine drinker, you enjoy wine and spirits, is to sort of, you know, what goes with what, and what should I do during the holidays, and are things out of season? And so I wanted to get an answer to that, and so I figured let's get a wine expert. So I've done that. Melissa Zeman, she is the queen over at over at the Wine House on Broadway. That's better than saying manager or anything, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. The Wine House is over on Broadway in Chicago and at 3164 North Broadway. So lots of things to learn. And we're going to get into that general stuff that everybody wants to know. But Melissa, you're joining me today for this podcast because there is an event coming up. So let's talk about that so people, we can be sure they hear that. It is December 6th, 5:30 to 7:30. What's going on at Wine House on December 6th?
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for having me on again, Paul. Sure. Love being a part of this. But next Wednesday on December 6th, we're hosting a high-end holiday wine tasting. And what we find is, obviously, around the holidays, people are buying more wine for parties and dinners and the holidays themselves, but also a lot more expensive bottles. And what we're doing is opening some bottles that are $50 and more and allowing people to get to try them because they might not often always get that chance to do so.
Oh, wow, how cool. So we come in, we're going to taste this expensive wine. So let me just ask you, all right? I mean, I buy expensive wine. I kind of like that, but I'm always kind of wondering whether I'm just being taken to the cleaners. And the reason for that is, I think, look, when you're dealing with a small winery and they don't, you know, make that many bottles of anything, that makes sense. Then I understand you have to have high prices. But is it fair enough to say that just because you pay a lot of money for a bottle of wine doesn't mean that is a better bottle of wine than something that might be $15?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are tons of amazing bottles that are very well made that fall in that, like, $10 to $25 price point. Like you said, though, there are some awesome bottles that are more expensive because they're smaller production, they're hand-harvested, there's a lot more that goes into it. There's a difference between cost for a winery, whether or not you're getting somebody to manually pick the grapes, or you're using a machine, which can keep costs down. So those kind of differences make a difference then in the resulting price.
And the bottom line is, for this event, it's such a rare opportunity. I mean, good luck going into some wine store and saying, you know, that $100 bottle of wine, open that up for me. I want to give it a little taste. Not
exactly.
Going to happen. Not going to
happen.
Yeah,
and that's what we're going to do.
So over at the Wine House, 3164 North Broadway, December 6th, 5:30 to 7:30. Check it out. And by the way, even if you can't go there at that time, every Wednesday and Friday during that time, you always have wine tastings, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We're always opening up bottles that are on our shelf. Our inventory kind of changes a lot, so we're experimenting with different things and then like to taste them out with our customers.
And I can say from personal experience, if you happen to have a little dog, feel free to bring them because there's a bowl of cookies for them while you're there.
We have our canine regulars, for sure.
Exactly. All right, let's talk a little bit about – people want information, chicagowinehouse.com is where you can get information on that event, December 6th. Let's talk about, in general, and give people some tips. Because, first of all, the whole concept of holiday wines. It's holiday time, it's Christmas, it's New Year's, it's Hanukkah, it's Kwanzaa. And so we've got to bring out the holiday wines. What the heck is a holiday wine?
It can mean different things to different people, obviously. What we hear a lot around the holidays are, I'm going to a holiday dinner, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or Hanukkah, and you want something to pair with the meal, whether you're having turkey, ham, vegetarian options. So that is a big thing. Some of those traditional dishes that are find on the dinner table, what pairs with those? Also, some special occasion wines, like champagne from France. Obviously, that is a popular item around the holidays as well, with New Year's right around the corner. But there are also some other alternatives. If you don't want to spend the money on champagne, you can get great sparkling wine from Spain, where it's called Cava, or Prosecco in Italy. There are definitely other options for every budget.
And by the way, is it true, the reason, if you're drinking champagne, I think the law is because it has to be from the Champagne region of France, right? It's not that everybody uses champagne as a generic term, like a Kleenex or like a Band-Aid. And of course, those are not generic terms. Those are brand names. Champagne in that respect is like a brand name, right? If I make champagne in Chicago, I can't call it champagne. What about Champagne, Illinois, though? I'm kidding.
I am so glad you brought that up. If there's one takeaway for any listeners today, it is that champagne can only be called champagne if it is from the region of Champagne in France. It's not necessarily a brand name, but it's definitely the region. So when it is from Champagne, France, it'll say Champagne on the label. Nowhere else is that allowed in the world. So
therefore, get a Brut, get a Cava, get Prosecco. It's okay. You're really drinking something that you will think is champagne anyway.
I guess so to some people, yes.
Right. And what we're going to learn is, especially like at this event coming up, but you know, when you taste finer wines, I mean, some people, I'm having a fine dinner party, so I feel like I need something expensive, but really that's one of the reasons you should be tasting wines, right? I mean, I'm not a wine connoisseur, but I know if I like a red or a white or something. And everybody's taste, do you basically respect people's tastes, or does somebody come in who doesn't know wine, well, I don't like that, or I like that, and do you say, well, because you're an idiot?
You know. Never out loud. No, just kidding.
Operative word there, out loud.
Wine is subjective, for sure. And I think that that's the fun part about wine, is finding things that people like. And one way, and sometimes people don't know what they like until they taste it, like you said. So there are free tastings all over Chicago. Chicago is a great wine town. I mean, outside of us, there are definitely other places. And so I always encourage people to taste as much as possible, because then they'll be able to accurately describe what they're liking in certain wines and what they're not liking. And then they can talk to their sommelier or wine retail manager or salesperson and tell them what they like so that they can be directed in the right direction.
And I'm so happy I get to ask all these questions. You'll answer, but ask these questions I've always wondered. Look, I love a Sauvignon Blanc, but I feel like I'm only allowed to drink that in the spring and the summer because it's light, it's refreshing, it feels like you should be on somebody's deck and having a Sauvignon Blanc. And I know a lot of people feel that same way about a rosé, that it's something you just drink in the summer. So are these myths, or are there certain wines that are only really appropriate to drink at certain times of the year?
Another topic I'm so glad you brought up. We are definitely a big rosé shop. We carry rosé year-round because we believe that rosé should be drunk year-round. It's definitely a misconception that rosé can only be drunk in the summer, probably because there are a lot of rosés that are released at the beginning of the summer and then sell out at the end of the summer. However, there are a lot of other ones that are available year-round that are just as wonderful with a variety of cuisines and dishes. I mean, if you're having people get sushi in the winter, so why not have a rosé with the sushi, or salads, or Thai food? I mean, insert cuisine here. Rosé is very versatile.
You also think that if we're having a nice dinner party or something, consider doing a dessert wine, which means obviously with dessert. Now, I'll be honest. When I think of, well, something like an ice wine, not so much a port or Sauternes, but those, as much as I enjoy red and white wine, I don't like dessert wines. Oftentimes, I would just say they're too sweet. Do you need a special palate to enjoy a dessert wine? What am I missing?
Well, I think it's also, again, kind of tasting a bunch of different kinds of dessert wines. And what's key here is the pairing of it. For example, fortified wine from Portugal, if you pair that, you can pair it with chocolate, you can pair it with blue cheese, and it's really amazing to see kind of the difference that it makes with the wine that you're tasting. So if you taste it on its own, it might be sweet, but when you taste it with blue cheese or with chocolate, it just takes the whole experience to another level. So it's definitely worth seeking out.
And you made a little reference to this concept earlier when you talked about pairing things, and here again. But for example, it's my mind, so I'm going to test it with you. I think if somebody's having a steak, if you eat steak or beef, it's got to be a red wine. If you're having fish or chicken, you're drinking a white wine. And I know those are general rules, but if you came to my home and I served you a steak and I said, you got to try this Sauvignon Blanc, is that a faux pas, or is it a matter of that would be me saying, I happen to like the way these things go together, so you can try it too?
I mean, I think that those are definitely general rules, but they're general rules for a reason. They've been tested time and time again, and the pairing just works. But again, like I mentioned, with wine being subjective, you should be able to break the rules and drink what you like and eat what you like at the same time. So, I mean, if you like red wine with fish, fine. Try a Pinot Noir, which is a little bit lighter.
It's a little lighter, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of different ways you can kind of mix and match things.
And so as we get ready for the holidays, is there also a rule in terms of how much people drink? I mean, I think I've always been told that like a bottle is for about four people. Obviously, if you have big wine drinkers, each one can drink their own bottle. But if you're just planning ahead or you're having a big party, you're having 50, 60 people over, is there a general – if I asked you, I've got 50 people coming over, how much wine do I need? What would you tell me?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a general rule, you can, out of a normal 750 milliliter bottle, you can get 4 to 5 glasses of wine out of that bottle, depending, again, about your pouring sizes for the glass. And then for sparkling wine, you can get a little bit more, since normally those are poured in flutes that are a little bit smaller. So. Mm-hmm. But that's the general rule. 4 to 5 glasses for a regular 750, and then about 6 or 7 for a champagne or a sparkling wine.
All right. And 750, by the way, referring to milliliters. That's not.
Yes, sorry. Yeah, right. 750 milliliter.
Okay. Well, I know, right. And also, if you have a party, sometimes you wonder, what should I serve? I kind of traditionally have like a Chardonnay there and a Cabernet or something like that. And it's interesting. Most people care less. Give me the red. Give me the white. What kind is it? I don't care. But then once in a while you get, oh, you have Chardonnay. Oh, I don't like Chardonnay. Is there if you're going to offer somebody a red and a white at a party, is something the most popular of each that here's what you ought to have?
Yeah, I think Chardonnay, because it can be so polarizing and there's so many different styles, like oaked or unoaked and things like that, think about maybe what you might be serving at the party and try to match with that. Generally, you could do like a white Bordeaux, which is Sauvignon Blanc based. That can be pretty versatile. Or try something a little bit different that would be unique but still work with a variety of cuisines. Like a Grüner Veltliner from Austria is a really cool one to match with some different appetizers, finger foods, things like that.
Well, now people are either going to have to rewind this or they're going to have to, or we're going to have you say it again. What do we get there?
It's a cool varietal called Grüner Veltliner, and you'll normally see that in Austria. But it's a really cool dry white wine that has sometimes a little bit of a spice on the finish. Mm-hmm. So I think dry white wine is what people most often will come in looking for a party. And there's a lot of different ones that fit the bill. So it's up to you on whether you want to get adventurous or stay the course a little bit with something more well-known.
This might be an unfair question, but when somebody tells me, here, have this wine, it was grown in Illinois, it was grown in Wisconsin, I'm kind of like, or Michigan, and I know they grow wine there, and if any of those people that, you know, are vintners listening to this are going to be mad at me, but I kind of have a mental block against these Midwestern locally grown wines, because my thinking is they're going to be very, very sweet, and that's good for some people, not for me, but it might be very good. Am I right that wines from around this region, they're never going to be a Cabernet, they're never going to be a Chardonnay, they're going to be more like these ice wine type things?
Yeah, I mean, the Midwest definitely has a strong presence of sweet wines. They are still experimenting with a lot of different things. And honestly, I mean, I don't think the Midwest has the kind of climate and soils and stuff to grow those international varietals like Cabernet and things like that. However, I will say that we actually, for our wine club for next month, we selected a sparkling wine from Illinois that is dry and amazing. So I'm really kind of excited to get that into our wine club members' hands and show them that Illinois is a lot more than just sweet wine.
And am I also a total snob that I don't like to drink wine out of plastic cups? I really want glass. And even at my home, when I've had large parties, 100 people, I buy glasses. I actually have glasses and stuff because I just think plastic is not the way to enjoy wine.
I mean, again, personal preference. I don't like drinking beer out of a can. I like to have a beer out of a glass. So, there are certain glasses that are better for wine that help release the aromas and you get more of the flavors, and there's definitely been studies done on that as well. But a vessel is a vessel sometimes to some people. So we have these one plastic wine glasses that are in the shape of a wine glass, but they're just plastic. So they do the job.
And they make sense for a lot of people, just maybe not this snob. Now, by the way, I've learned so much from you about wine over these years and stuff, but I'm going to use this public forum to say I taught you a little one thing about wine. It was to introduce you to a variety that, like, nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah, you definitely, the first time you came in, you were asking about Charbono, which is a really cool varietal. It's also known as Bonarda, but they grow some really cool expressions of Charbono out in California, which is the one that you were asking about.
Yeah.
So it's a cool grape, and we're seeking out if you like big reds.
And I've also grown to like Malbecs, which also typically was a mixing grape, not something that stood on its own, but now it does.
Yeah, Malbecs have one of those categories that people keep coming in for, especially obviously from Argentina, which has taken the grape to new heights. But what a lot of people don't know is that the grape originated in the southwest of France. And so France now is being like, hey, wait a minute, we started this. So they're coming out with some more interesting bottles from the homeland of Malbec.
So cool. Well, for people that have other questions, I assume, can we have them email you or call you to say, look, here's my question, and obviously we'll want them to come into the shop and try things out. What I love about your shop, by the way, this is you are not a huge store. This is not a place, I won't mention any other ones, but there's lots of places where they're just huge. You actually are a very small place right there on Broadway, as I've mentioned, 3164, and it's small, which means you have to be very careful about what you keep on the shelves.
Yeah, and I think, again, just shout out to this awesome city. I mean, Chicago's really great for independent retail in general, and we feel very fortunate to be in this really busy, bustling neighborhood and city, obviously, as well. But since we're an independent, small shop, we do work with the customers a lot. We try to, what do they want to see? What do they want to taste? What are they looking for? We do special orders all the time if they can't find things that are on our shelves. And like I said, mentioned earlier, our inventory does rotate a lot, so we're always trying out new things. There's a lot of wine out there, so I think I don't really want to get pigeonholed into one thing. Instead, it's arms are open and let's see what's out there.
And often because when I love to stop in just to sort of ask what's new, because there's always something a little different. And what I love about you, there are times you'll take something off the shelf and say, hey, let's just open this up. Let's try it out. Or here's something different that
yeah,
came in.
Yeah, don't tell too many people that.
No, it's an unusual thing.
No, but it's fun.
But sometimes you're just in the mood and we get to do that. And of course, I stop in more than I care to, because every time I pass by, my dog Matthew drags me in for the cookies that he knows are waiting for him. You can check them out at ChicagoWinehouse.com, correct? ChicagoWinehouse.com.
Yep.
And if people, can we give them your email there?
Absolutely, yeah. It's just melissa@chicagowinehouse.com, M-E-L-I-S-S-A.
That's easy enough. And for people that want to just call the store, talk to you, or talk to anybody, you all know so much about wine, what's the number where people can reach you?
Yeah, 872-802-3766. We have an awesome team here, so anybody can help you out if I'm not around, which
yeah.
is rare, because usually I'm around.
You're usually there. But by the way, it's not just the wine. There's really funky and often locally made chocolates, just different things that are just, every time I walk in there, you just never know what you're going to see. and I know you partner with other small businesses in the area, like the Lakeview Market. You've got some cookies made by Maggie, the chef down there, or the baker down there.
Yeah,
so
Velvet
cool
Dessert.
That,
They've been doing amazing stuff. Dr. Yeah. Ray's Toffee, which is a local guy. It's fun to partner with other businesses in the neighborhood. I think that's kind of what life is all about.
And it's a way to make that concept of Small Business Saturday that happens once a year, make it every day, because I really love supporting the small businesses in the area, because it's critical, right? Big boxes are lovely, but you need the small, and you get the kind of attention. You walk into your store, somebody's there to go, hi, what can I help you with? What questions can I answer? And I appreciate that. And it's why I wanted you to come on here and talk about just all this advice for the upcoming holiday season, because people have so many questions, and I hope we've answered at least most of them. But if we haven't, then contact Melissa, melissa@chicagowinehouse.com. Melissa, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. This was great.
Happy holidays.
I'll see you soon with your pups.
All right. You got it. Take care. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, @PaulLisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.